Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, we have a trilogy of reader questions for the first half of this week's pod. From the little-known way to beat inheritance tax, to bungalow wars and heat pumps making a racket, Simon and Lee answer them all. Also today, the fun police scrap the British ISA, and our Lee bemoans the death of the high street. But are we all to blame? Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, I imagine, ahead of Labour's first budget, This Is Money, you're getting a fair few questions related to inheritance tax. Well, we've picked one from a reader here, where it's actually a couple wanting to know how to give away surplus income. But what they want to know are the rules around it. Simon, Lee, Simon, as I said, it's a little known quirk, I suppose, of the inheritance tax system. Just explain the story and I suppose the wider principle we're discussing here.
So before we get onto this niche element of inheritance tax, we should talk about inheritance tax itself, which is something that's quite niche alone, because actually most people don't pay inheritance tax. Only a very small minority of estates pay it. The number is rising rapidly because the thresholds have remained frozen whilst people's wealth has been going up. But it's still the case that most people don't pay it. It is, however, Britain's most hated tax. And that's because people just really don't like the idea of it. It sounds quite unfair. And 40% is quite a large amount to take off people. So to go back to inheritance tax, how does it work? Everyone has £325,000, which is their nil rate band that they can give away on death, inheritance tax free. You can pass that on, your unused element of that, if you haven't given away any money in your lifetime that gets caught in the net, to your spouse on death or your civil partner. So that means that a couple could get up to £650,000. You then have this own residence nil rate band, which was brought in to sort of try to fudge the issue where lots of people's homes were being caught by inheritance tax. And that seemed inherently unfair because ultimately a lot of that is just house price inflation. It doesn't really benefit people until they die. Being dead is not generally seen as a benefit, and so on and so on. That takes up the total amount that a couple can give away inheritance tax free to £1 million, because there's an extra £350,000 worth, 175 each, if you pass on your own home to a direct descendant, i.e. your children or your grandchildren. Above that £1 million, everything will face tax at 40%. And if you hit £2 million, you start having the residence nil rate band taken off you until you reach a point where it's all gone and you're back to 650. Owing to the fact that most people don't successfully plan for inheritance tax in their lifetimes, if they aren't super rich, there is also a situation where basically the effective rate of inheritance tax goes up in a curve and then starts to come back down. And I apologize to all the people listening to this who can't see what I'm doing with my finger right now to illustrate what a curve going up and coming back down looks like. But ultimately, there was an Office of Tax Simplification report, dates back to 2018, brilliantly never acted on. 2018, you don't need to be a maths genius to realize it was 6 years ago, which illustrated that once you got above about £3 million, the effective rate of tax started to decline because people started to take advantage of major reliefs, things like owning agricultural land and stuff like that. The stuff that the really, really rich use to not pay inheritance tax on their estates. But there is a niche that we are talking about here, which the not so really, really, really rich can use to also avoid inheritance tax. And this relates to being able to give away more money than the very strict limits that there are on what you can give away each year without it falling into the inheritance tax net. And before I go on to that niche, I should mention what these limits are, because they're really quite special. Okay. These date back to the 1980s. You don't need to be a genius to know that life has got quite a lot more expensive since the 1980s. So you could give away, free of inheritance tax, up to £3,000 per year. £3,000. Now, this does technically mean that somebody who bought their child a car when they reached 18, for example, a secondhand car that cost £5,000, would have breached their annual £3,000 allowance. Slightly mad, but, you know. You do get a higher one, though, where you can give away a special amount of money if your children get married. And that's up to £5,000. Weddings are quite a lot more expensive than £5,000 these days. You get £2,500 from your grandparents, and you can also get £1,000 from anyone else. So you could tap up your guests. Bear in mind that the tax is levied on the people giving the money away, not the people receiving it. Okay. So it's, you could give up to £1,000 to somebody else who's getting married. And if you gave £2,000 to two different people who are getting married in the same year and you died within 7 years, there would be a risk that there would be inheritance tax liability. You can give up small gifts up to £250 each recipient per year. And then there's no limit on the gifts you can give to political parties, you'll be glad to know, and no limit on the gifts you can give to charities. But there's also this normal expenditure out of income rule, which means that if the conditions are met and you're able to maintain your standard of living and it comes out of your income, not your capital, so you can't take the money out of your savings account, you can't take the money out of your investments, so on, and give it to someone, you can give away as much as you want without it falling in within the net. And just to say that if you do give away more than these sums, there's nothing to stop you giving away more than these sums. You give away as much as you want in any given year. But in order for it not to get caught by inheritance tax at all, you have to survive for 7 years after you've given it. If you die within that 7 year period, tax is charged, but it's charged at a sliding scale. So you don't get the full 40%, for example, in year six. It's notched down and tapered back.
So that's the theory. You have this couple, they want to know a few more details, but what are the things that you have to do? You're talking about giving money, and this really blows people's mind who have never heard of this, that if you have spare income, you can just give it away. Oh, what about 7 years? No. You can just give it away. Well, how much? How often? When you said it has to be regular, I mean, we're talking about every week, every month. If you sell a property, presumably, and you have a lump sum, that doesn't count. But could you just drip feed it?
And this is where this starts to get really, really murky, okay? Because this exemption, it is called normal expenditure out of income. I mean, what in God's name does that mean? Normal expenditure, right.
Coffee? So, I mean, are we talking that sort of limit? I mean,
yeah, exactly. You know, you can buy someone a coffee every day and it's fine.
Yeah, but... Because we hear this has been mentioned with school
fees,
for example,
whatever
but
you do, don't
normal.
Buy them more than £250 worth of coffee in a year, otherwise you'll be in trouble. So, in order to qualify, okay, HMRC says taxpayers must satisfy the following for the gift. It formed part of the transferor's normal expenditure, was made out of income, left the transferer with enough income for them to maintain their normal standard of living. So let's work backwards. Right. Left the transferer with enough income for them to maintain their normal standard of living. Okay. So basically, you can't be giving away so much money that you're all of a sudden not able to, you know, heat your home, feed yourself, go to the shops and so on. Or suddenly there's a noticeable sudden kind of like, you know, reining back of your existence. Okay, so I mean, it's quite difficult to establish what is someone's normal standard of living, but I think you could probably set a reasonable baseline. We could all think about, well, what's the baseline, you know? If I, it doesn't mean that, like, just because you went on holiday last year you have to go on holiday this year and so on, but it is like keeping that kind of normal kind of level, right? Was made out of income. What's income? Income is money you've got coming in. Now, income could, for example, be a pension. It doesn't have to be earned income. It could be pension. It could be savings interest. It could be dividend income. What it can't be is investment bonds that you're cashing in. Okay. So you can't be selling your investments to do this. Now, there's a slightly gray area talking about this, because if you've got your pension invested, which most people will do nowadays, and this illustrates again why, you know, so many of these things are outdated. You've got a defined contribution pension that you've then kept invested and you're drawing on through your retirement, which you're doing through the, you know, pension freedom stuff that's been around for quite some time now. It might be that rather than drawing dividend income from your pension pot for your income, you're doing what many financial advisors recommend that you do, and you're actually potentially taking some capital gains as well, that you're selling investments and then taking that out, because there's no capital gains tax charged within a pension. It might be that actually you're being really quite canny with your retirement investment income strategy, and you're not drawing on your pension above the amount that is your personal tax-free allowance every year, and you're taking money out of an ISA instead. And when you're taking that money out of an ISA, you're withdrawing it either from cash ISAs, you're taking it out of cash ISA savings accounts, or you're selling investments to do it. So is that income? I mean, and also people don't take the same amount every month. It's quite lumpy. I think, though, this is where we're going to get onto this in a minute, like the really important bit of keeping records comes in. You need to keep the records that proves it, right? If you just randomly sell some investments and take the money out and then give it to someone, not going to work. If you can show that this has been your retirement income strategy, going to work. And then we get to the formed part of the transfer as normal expenditure. Well, your normal expenditure doesn't usually involve giving sums of money to other people, does it? Your normal expenditure, like we just joked about,
it's your parent,
is things like coffee and your bills and your food shopping and stuff like that. But HMRC refers to a pattern of giving in its notes. And look, I'm going to read this out, okay? This is not riveting, I warn you. Okay?
All right.
Okay. This is from the HMRC website. Okay. Lifetime transfers, conditions for normal out of income expenditure, normal expenditure. The dictionary definition of normal includes standard, regular, typical, habitual, or usual. For the purpose of this exemption, normal means normal for the transferer and not for the average person. In most cases, it will be clear whether or not there is a pattern of giving, but it is not always that simple. It is possible that a number of gifts made by one person may not qualify. It is also possible for a single gift to qualify if it is or is intended to be the first of a pattern, and there is evidence of this. You will need to analyse all the facts in case of doubt to see if a pattern can be found. Factors to take into account in looking at any pattern of gifts include the frequency and amounts, the nature of the gifts, the identity of the donees, and the reasons for the gifts. Clear as mud, isn't it?
No.
But where there's something that's that vague, you might get caught out by the vagueness, but you could also potentially drive a bus through it. Mm. And there are people who are using this, who have got surplus income, okay? They're people who are lucky enough to have large amounts of pension income. They've got savings, they've got investments, they're having a comfortable retirement, they're not scraping around, okay? And they are able to use this in order to give money regularly to members of family, most likely, or other people. Doesn't have to be monthly, doesn't have to be quarterly. It could potentially even be annually. The normal expenditure, and they're giving it to people, and it means that it falls outside of the inheritance tax net. And there's some examples that are given by financial advisors, you know, when you start looking into this, and people are managing to give away really quite large sums of money, but are way above those extremely strict and outdated limits, the £3,000 a year and stuff, because there are people out there listening to this podcast, or parents of people listening to this podcast, grandparents of people listening to this podcast, who could probably give away tens of thousands of pounds a year, still maintain their standard, their normal standard of living, and it would be out of their income.
Lee, in your experience of, you know, being an editor of a publication, etc., someone said you can either drive a bus through it or you can get really caught out. What are you seeing the majority of here? I get people getting away with stuff more often than who gets to decide, presumably HMRC, on what criteria?
Oh, man, we need an office for tax simplification, don't we? God rest its soul. to help unravel some of this. I think, first of all, just to point out here that some of this is just so outdated. It is ripe for reform. It is ripe be shaken up and sorted out once and for all, because there is so much confusion around inheritance tax. And quite often what happens is people leave it too late, panic, and kind of never end up sorting it out. And it just means lots of money ends up going to the tax man when it might necessarily not have needed to, and could have gone to your children, grandchildren, other family members, friends. It becomes one of those things, I think people bury their head in the sand and go, oh God, it's just all fiendishly complicated. I'll think about it next year. You know, if you are someone in that, or your parent or your grandparent is someone in that boat, you know, just go and get paid for one-off financial advice is what I would say, and go and find out, you know, how to actually navigate some of this. Now, in terms of you get caught out, I mean, we receive hundreds of emails from readers every single week, and I'm yet to hear from anyone that has been massively caught out by using the rules that Simon was talking about. And I actually think there really are, they're really sort of unknown rules, because I think most people know about the 7-year rule. I think lots of people have that in their mind. I think lots of people know about the £3,000 limit. And even like, you know, the £5,000 limit for a wedding. I mean, £5,000 for a wedding doesn't get you very far these days. It would have done in the 1980s when these limits were set. But I mean, £5,000 just about covers the cost of a DJ and a photographer these days. I mean, it's, you know, it's not a huge amount of money. I mean, it is a huge amount of money for some people. Sorry, that's not the correct way to say it. But for some people, that it doesn't touch the size, depending on what kind of grand vision you have for your wedding. But from experience, I would say that although lots of people are kind of fearful of inheritance tax, you know, as Simon pointed out, it's only a few percent of people that actually ever get clobbered by this. And as a result, we don't have a huge amount of people get in touch with kind of encountering problems. Now, that might be a kind of pride thing. That might be a kind of, we knew about the rules, or, you know, a family member knew about the rules, but we just kind of, you know, it's too morbid to talk about, and it all just kind of, you know, ended up, it was just easier not to talk about it, and we all just lost out. But we don't get a huge amount of that, Georgie. I must say. But you know what to do if you are in this situation, or you have been in this situation, or you've got questions about it. Get in touch with us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk, and we'll always field your inheritance tax questions. And the reason why we're bringing this up and talking about this is, obviously, in about 6-7 weeks time, we've got the budget. Yeah. And there's lots of things that are kind of on the table, and lots of things up for kind of people are worried about, you know, what changes could happen, including inheritance tax. Inheritance tax, you would probably expect, is fairly high up the Labour agenda. The house price growth has really kind of caught a lot of people into this trap, and lots of people that I would just call sort of middle class, call them kind of rich, or just call them sort of people that bought well in London and the southeast, not completely exclusive to them, but a large number of them. You could argue, is it unfair? Is it fair? Well, you know, there'll be people listening to this podcast saying, well, only a few percent people pay it, so what does it matter? Then there'll be other people that have been caught out by it and gone, oh, it's absolutely ridiculous. You know, I pay tax all my life, and then I die, and then a load of other more tax that goes on to this. And that's, you know, I think that's where
I'm dead. I don't care.
Yeah, you're dead. You don't care. But you know,
I don't have kids as well, so that's slightly different.
Maybe the last few months of your life, you do start to think, oh, I just wish I'd done something.
Business, Lee.
Not everyone obviously has. You might drop dead tomorrow. But, you know, there's lots of people that I think just don't do the sufficient planning because of the morbid kind of nature of it, and because it's complicated.
Well, that's why so many people don't have a will, I would imagine. But anyway, Simon, look, we're talking about this excess income. If you don't fancy just dropping wafts of cash all over your relatives or whoever wants it, how can you use it? I mentioned school fees. What other ways?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. And it was probably going to be of quite a lot of interest to some people listening to this podcast who might be in the position where they know that, you know, as I said, their parents, their grandparents, or people listening to this who know that they're in the position, and, you know, their children, their grandchildren, and so on. So it's like, how does this, you know, how could this practically work? And how could you actually use this to really help, you know, improve the finances of your family, you know, or your friends if you want to, but also without just bunging them large amounts of cash, because there are risks with bunging people large amounts of cash. Obviously, this is an exemption that involves not just bunging people large amounts of cash in one-off sums. So, you know, you need to bear that in mind for a start. But also, you know, many people they worry about what will happen with it. There's always the unreliable partner somewhere going on. With one of the children has an unreliable partner. There's the moral hazard element, you know, you could pay your kid's mortgage off, but like, maybe it's good for them to have a mortgage. You know, the financial discipline that comes with it. What are they going to do with the spare money? If they were going to use the spare money every month to, you know, put into their pension so they've got a richer retirement, or build up good savings or investments, or, you know, build up a business or something, fine. But if they're just going to use the extra money every month to swan off on fancy holidays or buy designer goods and new sofas and big TVs or stick a, you know, Porsche Boxster on the drive, you might think that maybe you don't want to pay off your kid's mortgage, and it's good for them to have a mortgage so they can't do all those things unless they work a lot harder and earn some more money. So it's quite complicated. And this actually comes into play there, because people you see are happy to give their kids money to go towards like a deposit for a house, for example, the bank of mum and dad thing. But then they're just giving them a load of money to stick in their bank account for the reasons that I just gave you becomes an issue. Now, with something like this, you can use it, for example, you could regularly pay into your children's pension, and you're going to get a double whammy there, because you're saving the inheritance tax and you're also getting the pension tax relief for them on the money that's going into the pension. You know, it's going to get boosted by if you pay money into someone else's pension, it'll get that basic rate uplift. You could pay into a pension for grandchildren, for example. I mean, this is a great way. If you know that you're going to get hit by inheritance tax, if your estate's going to get hit by inheritance tax, if you know that, do something about it. Fly business class for a start. All business class flights, 40% off, because if there's going to be money left at the end, treat yourself. Spend on yourself first. But then, you know, pay into your grandchildren's pension a little bit. You know, going into that regularly, and then all of those years of compounding is going to make a massive difference. Pay into a junior ISA for them. Pay into a totally separate account if you want to, and you want them to, you know, to have a bit more restriction on it. It could be the thing that means that when they are in their late 20s, you know, early 30s, they are able to buy a property. You could also, for example, school fees. School fees are, again, a niche issue, right? I don't pay school fees. My children are at state school. But I have friends who pay school fees. And there is one big thing on their mind at the moment, and that's the 20% VAT. And that's because the friends that I have who are paying school fees fall into that bracket where we need a new name for these people. They're not the squeezed middle. As we talked about last week, middle earners are literally on the median salary, and they are not sending their kids to private school. But they're the people on the kind of 50 to 100 to 150 grand kind of thing. Lots of money, higher rate taxpayers, but not super rich. And 20% on school fees is going to make a big difference to those kind of people. Maybe if you're a parent or a grandparent and you know that your children have got children at a private school and they're grumbling about this, going, oh God, this is really going to hurt us kind of thing, you could just pick up the VAT on it out of your, you know, do it regularly. That is a regular pattern of spending. It comes out of your income, you know, and so on and so on. So there are ways that you can use this to actually think practically, okay, what little differences could I make to help the lives of the loved ones? And then I can see the benefits of that when I'm alive, which is often one of the reasons why people are happy to give money for house deposits. It's like, well, I'd rather give them the money now when I can go around their house and they can make me dinner and they can say bloody thank you than when I'm dead. And, you know, that's a good reason for doing this kind of stuff.
Quite, Simon, quite. Right, we're going to stick with inheritance. Not the tax, but the actual beneficiary here. So meanwhile, do you remember back in May, I think it was, we discussed on the pod about bungalow wars, very popular as they are. I assume they are still fairly popular. Lee, are they still fairly popular, bungalows?
Yep,
hence why we've got a question here from the reader who had read that story on your website. Lo and behold, they and their son had just inherited a £600,000 bungalow in a London suburb. They don't want to be landlords, fair enough, but they don't know whether it's worth selling up once probate is all complete, etc. So selling up as soon as they can, or holding off a few years in the hope that the value will go up. Now, neither need the money now for various reasons. They can wait for a few years. But what bills and taxes they want to know would they need to think about and to pay for with an unoccupied house. I'm wondering also if things like insurance and security and all that sort of thing. But anyway, and if they do decide to sell now, Lee, where would be the best place to put the money? So first, remind us about why are bungalows so popular?
They're just popular because, you know, they could give that kind of a bit more open plan living sometimes, depending on the format of the house. Obviously, popular with older people because there's not stairs. And they're popular with younger people as well because they see them as a kind of bargain way to get onto the property market sometimes. You know, bungalows can be quite expensive, and do them up, add on an extra story and that kind of stuff. So they're quite ripe. And also, we don't build many of them anymore. Whenever you see these new build estates, they're usually 3, 4, 5 bed homes with postage stamp gardens. You know, bungalows are not really being built that much, so there's quite a big demand for them. And you know, I've seen some examples around my way of absolutely astronomical money bungalows, and I think, wow. But people are buying them, and quite, as I say, quite often it's a downsizing option for people. Now, this is not a bad problem to have. I mean, inheriting a £600,000 home from a relative, so it's in a London suburb. Says here, I've inherited 75% and my son 25%. The thing is, when you have an unoccupied home, there is quite a lot to think about. Now, firstly, I should point out here that there's no guarantee that just because house prices have been rising and back rising again, we've had a Halifax report out today suggesting that house prices are back on the move. That's not to say that this is definitely going to keep on growing in value. And we don't know what state this bungalow is in. You know, sometimes it needs more, they need modernization. Someone will come in, a potential buyer, and say, this whole thing needs doing over. So, you know, you say it's worth £600,000, but is it definitely worth £600,000? You know, it's kind of a bit of a relative thing to kind of say. Then there's lots of upkeep, you know, maintenance. When a house is unlived in for a while, you know, there's certain, it can feel, you know, quite cold in there. There could be lots of little things that go wrong. You've also got to still pay things like council tax just because there's not someone living in there. And sometimes, depending on the council, the council tax could be more. They add an extra levy on there, so you have to find out from the council whether that's true or not. You've got the capital gains tax kind of element of this. If that house price does go up from the point that you inherited it to the point that you sell it, you could be on the hook for that. That could eat in quite a lot. And then actually, I think becoming a landlord is a lot of work. You know, it's also all well and good to say we can list this, rent it out, have someone come in, we're going to get an income from it, but you know, you can have lots of headaches from becoming an accident, especially becoming an accidental landlord, i.e. someone that's got a property that they weren't ever planning to be a landlord, and then they become one. You realise how much drain it is on your time, depending on the kind of things that you end up getting asked to do. There's also other things, there's other sort of risks with vacant properties, you know, vandalism, theft, squatters, water damage. As you say, you know, insurance. I mean, lots of people probably end up neglecting the insurance on something like this because they think of insurance as their contents, and there probably isn't anything in this bungalow worth value. But, you know, you still have to have the actual building insured. There's gas, electric, all that kind of thing that you have to think about. But at the same time, there is still a potential reward element here if you do hold on to it. Lots of people obviously invest in property and see property as a great thing to hold, but it isn't very diversified. I don't know this person's ins and outs. I don't know whether they've got investments and, you know, money tucked away elsewhere, split around different things. Just having it all riding in this bungalow is probably not the wisest investment strategy. But again, like I said earlier, if you're really in doubt with this and thinking about what to do, I think a financial advisor could be worth their weight in salt, something like this, especially if you pay for one-off advice, which is much easier to do these days, and then make a decision from there. But again, we've got a budget next month. The CGT rules could all be shaken up and changed. Currently, the CGT is charged 80% for basic rate and 24% for higher rate taxpayers on residential property that's not your main home. Could that rise? You know, that's the thing. You know, and if you started selling the property now, would it be a wiser decision? I don't know. As I say, sometimes these things can be quite what I would describe as quite a lovely headache. You know, you've got this thing, but you want to make sure that you make the right financial decision and that you maximize the kind gift that you have received from someone. You want to make sure there's that kind of pressure to make sure that you do what you deem to be the right thing. And it's a hard one without knowing all of the ins and outs of this person's kind of financial health. What to say, but £150,000 for a son who's going to use that for a future property deposit. Lovely.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great. And then, you know, you take that money and then you want to make sure you max out your ISA for one. You want to make sure all of your money's spread around and, you know, deposited so you've not got all your eggs in one basket for the financial services compensation scheme of £85,000 for definite. And this person who's got the 75% chunk is talking about using it for their retirement. I mean, lovely. But you want to make sure that you're investing that right to hopefully give you an annual income added on to whatever else your retirement plan is. And it sounds great. That sounds like a real boost to someone's pension just to suddenly get £450,000.
Yeah, quite.
As I say, wonderful, beautiful headache.
Yeah, quite. Our final reader question today, though, it's about noisy heat pumps. So they've just got back from holiday, it may or may not be Simon, where they stayed in a French house by the beach that had a heat pump in the back garden that made a pretty constant low level but intrusive fan sound. Think in a restaurant kitchen, that kind of whirring sound. Am I right, Simon? Do you think that's what the reader's thinking there? Was that what it sounded like? Do you think? Pretty annoying, they say, when you're trying to have a nice rosé in the back garden. Just describe what the sound might have been like, Simon.
I'm going to do some role play here and just put myself in the shoes of the kind of reader who might have just got back from a holiday in France and might have spent the first week of it by the beach on the Atlantic coast, the kind of place where you've got a garden that goes, you know, into the gate opens to the pine forest over the dunes. Beautiful. And you're on the beach. You could sit in the garden, you know, at night time, you could hear the sound of the cicadas. You could hear the sound of the waves. You could hear nature around you. Effectively, you're in the forest. You might earlier on have been sat there having a sundowner with a glass of pink wine. And then you might be sitting out later, maybe with a bottle of red and enjoying a chat after having had a nice barbecue. And the whole time thinking, I wish that noise would stop. Yeah, it was me.
Yeah, was it you? Okay. Reason that we're mentioning is this because, well, it's made you think, is this what all heat pumps
Do you know what it made me think? Thank God I didn't get a heat pump.
Yes. So what does it sound like, Simon? Can you just kind of give us a...
It sounded like a fan. It sounded like a loud fan. It sounded exactly like, you know, when you go past a takeaway restaurant, they've got the big ducts coming outside. They've got the big fans. It sounded like that. And it made me think...
All the time?
Not all the time, okay. But much more often and for longer than I would have thought, which is where this feeds into the thank God I didn't get a heat pump. People who've been listening to this podcast regularly, people who've been listening for some time will know that basically last year, effectively built a new house, right? Mm-hmm. We didn't completely build a house. We went just down to the downstairs walls, built a new house. We did a self-build project. As part of that, we obviously put in a new heating system, got underfloor heating downstairs, trying to make the house as energy efficient as possible. Mm-hmm. And then it came down to the choice, boiler, heat pump. Mm-hmm. Heat pump was going to add about another 15 grand to it. And I was just like, we just can't afford it. It's just too much. And I think this is one of the problems we've got with heat pump adoption is it is expensive. And you get to the point where even people like me who are effectively building a new house, trying to make it as energy efficient as possible and so on, I don't have any more money. And that bit of money I have has to go into other stuff. Mm-hmm. So we got a boiler. Boiler has gone into the like kind of boiler plant room utility bit at the back of the garage. The heat pump would have gone in the garden. The heat pump probably would have stuck it in the back garden. I don't know whether I would have quite twigged how intrusive it would have been. I mean, we might have stuck it down the side of the house. Only down one side of the house do you have enough room for it. On the other side, our house is quite close. It's detached, but it's quite close to the other house next door. And actually, that's not the side where, you know, all the heating controls are and everything. So it probably would have gone in the back garden. Now, this heat pump was sat there. You know, you couldn't hardly see it. The owners of the house had put some kind of like bamboo not planted bamboo, but you know, the kind of bamboo fencing kind of over the front of it, obviously to try and hide it. You wouldn't really notice it in the daytime when you're out in the garden, when it was on. You might notice it a bit when you were out there barbecuing or something. But I tell you what, you'd notice it when you were sat down to dinner, when you're talking over dinner, and you definitely notice it after people have gone to bed and you were sat out reading, having a glass of wine. Mm. And bear in mind, we're on holiday somewhere warm, so there's no heating on. So this must have only been running for the hot water. We're coming back from the beach, we're having showers. So presumably that's why it was kicking in the evening. But then it was staying on for ages. It was staying on for way longer than I would expect my boiler to stay on, you know, to heat water. And it seemed to be making more noise than my boiler would make. But I came back, spoke to Sam Barker. Sam Barker looked into this for us. And he makes the point that actually, you know, most heat pumps are about the same noise as a boiler, about 40 to 60 decibels. At the lower end of the scale, that's about the volume of birdsong or a microwave. And at the upper end of the scale, about as loud as a typical conversation. But that most people's boilers are located in out-of-the-way locations. Although I've lived in places where the boiler's in the kitchen and things like that. And you did notice it there. And yeah, you're not normally in your garden. Maybe it doesn't matter. But if you are sensitive to noise, this is definitely something to think about. And you need to think about, if you are going to get one, where you're going to put it. Because it might be that you could put it outside, but you could put it outside as far away as possible from where you would normally be sitting outside. And then you're not going to notice it in the same way that you don't notice your boiler that's off somewhere else in the house. Or it might be that you think, oh, you know what? It doesn't look that bad. We'll just stick it in the back garden. Or you don't have room to do that. And then you might suddenly find that you have put something in that's going to drive you absolutely bonkers. I mean, I
for a lot of money as well.
Noise than most people. So, but for many people, it probably wouldn't be a problem. My wife said, thank you for drawing that to my attention. Yeah. I can now hear it every time it comes on.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Dan Beecroft of Charles Stanley for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Dan, we've got to read a question, a topical one. It's on capital gains tax. I've got some shares outside of an ISA that I've made £5,000 worth of profit on. I'd like to sell them now to cash in the gain in case capital gains tax rises. Can I transfer some to my wife to use her allowance too?
So the simple answer is yes. Capital gains tax is obviously a concern for many investors at the moment as the Labour government looks to potentially increase the rates. Currently, there's a £3,000 capital gains tax allowance. This is the amount of gain you're allowed to make without paying any tax. After that, the £2,000 gain on the shares would be taxable at either 10% or 20%, depending on the marginal rate of tax. Spousal transfers are a really good way to utilise any unused £3,000 allowance that the wife might have. You will not incur any capital gains tax by gifting the shares to the wife, and she could then sell down the investments in her name, providing both husband and wife have not used their capital gains tax allowances. If they plan this transaction effectively, the gain will be capital gains tax free.
So the gain would be split across the couple, but we've got another part to this question from our reader. What price would my wife use when she sells? Would it be the price I paid for the shares or the value when I gave them to her?
So the wife is deemed to have acquired the shares at the same price the husband paid. So she will calculate the gain exactly the same way the husband would, but she'll get to utilise her capital gains tax allowance.
So there's not a very clever way of just nullifying capital gains by passing shares and investments backwards and forwards forever and ever.
Unfortunately not, no.
Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Bye-bye, British ISA. Before it had even had the chance to see the light of day, it's been unceremoniously dumped by the government. That's despite insisting that it wouldn't scrap it just months ago. So, Simon, what was the British ISA exactly? What was it intended for?
Well, the British ISA was an idea to get us to invest more money into British-listed companies, and it was going to try and boost the somewhat moribund nature of the UK stock market. We've had a problem where there's more and more companies deciding to not list in the UK some companies deciding to leave the UK and go list in the US, for example, instead. Other big companies considering maybe going somewhere else, and also companies getting taken over, and then new companies not coming into the market to fill the space into the FTSE 350, 250, 100. So the idea was this would give retail investors, i.e. you, me, Lee, other people listening to this podcast, an extra £5,000 on top of their £20,000 tax-free annual ISA allowance to invest in London-listed stocks to boost UK businesses. There was some question as to how this was going to boost UK businesses. Many businesses listed in the UK do most of their business outside of the UK. There are also things like investment trusts. There are foreign companies that are listed here. It all gets a bit kind of murky. What was going to qualify? What wasn't going to qualify? A consultation was done. It was all very exciting, but now it's just been completely binned off. I mean, it was going to be a bit of a gimmick and overly complicated because it was going to be an extra ISA. It wasn't just going to be £5,000 extra in your normal ISA allowance. We were going to create yet another ISA, yet another separate product. That, to me, seems silly. But supporters of this kind of thing say, look, you know, if you're going to get a tax break for investing, then yeah, there's nothing wrong with directing it towards people investing in, you know, stocks listed in that country. Give it to your own, you know, stock, try to boost your own stock market rather than allowing people to just, you know, go out and buy US stocks that totally dominate the market. There are others who say gimmick, too complicated, needed to be binned off. Anyway, the fund police in the form of Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves have stepped in and stopped this one too.
Just explain, Simon, how when the FTSE is filled with companies that are not British, how it would benefit to do it that way. Wouldn't it be better to have it so you have to invest only in British companies, or is that too difficult? Or
That's quite difficult. I mean, effectively what you're doing is you're creating extra demand for UK listed shares. And if you create extra demand for UK listed shares, you know, that then trickles down into, you know, boosting those companies' share prices. Boosting a company's share price doesn't involve directly giving it money, but it does benefit the company when it comes to, you know, its kind of its own capital position and stuff like that. And it is generally seen as good. And it would also then encourage maybe more companies from overseas to come here and go, hey, look, the UK really backs investment in its own companies, and so on and so on and so on. It creates a little bit of a halo and a positive effect. It very nebulous, but that is the idea behind it.
Well, as we discussed last week, creating a halo effect around Britain at the moment doesn't seem to be on Labour's agenda.
It doesn't seem to be on the government's agenda, creating a halo effect. No, for some bizarre reason. I'm increasingly, you know, as you go round meeting up with people, talking to them, having a coffee, having lunch, catching up with them, I'm meeting a wall of incomprehension amongst people as to what on earth this gloom-laden plan is and why they're doing it. And this is coming from people who didn't vote Labour, did vote Labour, you know, all the other things of like, what on earth are they doing? Everyone was quite positive in July and they've totally killed it off.
Lee, while Simon was talking there, I can see he was setting up his soapbox. Onto it now he steps. Lee's chosen subject this week is the death of the high street. Lee, the floor is yours.
I won't be setting up my soapbox on the high street because no one will be there to listen to me.
Touché.
I don't think. I did a column this week. I've had actually quite a lot of quite nice reader emails, actually, which is a nice turn up for the book. So people saying that sort of agreed with the tone of the column. So, you know, the high street has been in a kind of decay, I would say, over the last 10, 15, 20 years anyway. But I think there's a couple of further nails into the coffin here that are just making it, we should just accept that the high street is as good as dead, and that we should do something else with them, aka just make them residential hubs the way things are going. Now, the reason why I say this is because, number one, the rise of these Chinese retail websites, we spoke about these a little while ago, actually, Georgia, didn't we, with AliExpress. But AliExpress, Shein and Temu, I'm being surprised by the amount of people that have told me that they shop on these Chinese websites. People I would never expect people that are basically paying rock bottom prices for dubious quality items, but seemingly don't really care at all that that's the case. And the other one is, there's been a real rise in the out-of-town retail parks, those soulless places where you get most of the retail big boys now setting up shop in giant car parks with a one-in, one-out car sort of system onto A roads. So these are kind of being built on land next to A roads, right? And they're vast. They're kind of taking over from what would be people going into the high street. And the reason for that, there's a couple of things at play here. So I think that, firstly, it's fiendishly difficult now to park in your local high street. There's all sorts of restrictions. There's parking charges. Councils have just been ramping it up and ramping it up to a point where people have just fed up and they've voted with their feet. The fiddly apps, all of that kind of stuff. And then you've got the kind of poor transport links and people just heading for the cheaper prices online, and also to these retail parks if you've got a car, because you don't have to pay for parking, and it's just a what you would say is a simpler experience. Now, I'm not saying that I'd never ever visit these out-of-town retail parks, but I'd much rather go to a vibrant, buzzy high street than one of these identikit kind of retail parks that I would say, you know, have been a real, really pushed by companies like Next and M&S. They've gone quite hard on this, and then you've got places like McDonald's and Greggs that are in these places, and people are just heading there rather than the high street. And I think that it's a real shame. And if that is the case, then as I say, I think we should just rethink about what we're doing with the high street, because you can't build homes on this land next to the A roads, because, you know, they're noisy, they're not ideal for kind of residential estates, so they're building these retail parks. So then you could argue that high streets are away from sort of busy A roads on the whole, not always, but quite often, and just say, instead of all these boarded up shops or yet another charity shop or coffee shop or betting shop, you know, they just need to be we just need to accept that what we know is the high street is dead. It's dead and buried.
Right.
I still visit my high street, you know, I do, but definitely over the last 12, 18 months, shops have been disappearing, banks have been disappearing. I think that has a big effect because, you know, people might be less likely to head into town to go to the bank, and shops, retailers find it difficult to then deposit money that their earnings and takings. And it's all kind of building up into this kind of way in which I feel like the whole high street shopping experience is done for. And then I'm not even factoring in things here like business rates, overhead costs, you know,
parking,
energy bills that are still high. And then it all just goes back into, if I go around the roundabout, we just go back to the car park charges as well. And that's what lots of people have kind of got in touch with, that basically car park charges have just done it for them, and they're rather just going to retail park because they're less likely to get done. You know, less likely to get fined or whatever from whatever route it is they're taking. And, you know, kind of find it easier to park there. This is the direction it feels like it's all going. And then there was some research from this e-commerce marketing platform called Omnisend saying that 3 in 5 shoppers, rising to 4 in 5 Gen Z, have bought goods from a Chinese shopping website in the past year. So that's anywhere near true. I mean, that is a huge amount of money that's been sucked away from our high street shops. And if you're someone that shops on these websites and you're happy with the choice and the cheaper cost, then don't worry about it. The high street's use it, lose it mentality, it's gone, it's done. And that's what the whole point of this kind of this article is, really. You know, if you haven't been to your local high street for a while, and you know, they are getting a bit more downtrodden, Georgia. I don't think there's any way you can mask that. And perhaps your local high street is better than...
Mine's all right, I'll be honest with you, Lee. Mine's all right. But if I didn't live within walkable distance of my high street, I wouldn't go, because there is nowhere to park apart from a Waitrose car park, which probably says the sort of area that my high street is in. Charlie, I just think we should all stay at home. You know, work from home, stay at home, go into the metaverse.
You want to go and have experiences.
Lee, metaverse, that's where it's all at.
Man, what are you talking about?
Nah, man. Anything positive from this story, though, Lee? You want us to all read it? It sounds a bit miserable.
Well, we have that local high street here, right, has actually quite ample parking. And what happens is on a Saturday after 1 p.m. and all day Sunday, the parking is free. And you can just see the change when that parking gets free. And I think that the council, I think councils need to rethink their strategy over parking costs and how complicated that they're making it for shoppers. And I think that something needs to happen in terms of things like business rates to give the high street a shot in the arm, start making it a more vibrant place again to go. And I say, this is not all high streets, Georgie, but if you're building an out-of-town retail park, it's going to naturally suck away a lot of the high street footfall. And it's a kind of chicken and egg scenario, isn't it? It's also just a downward spiral effect on the high street because, you know, fewer people are going to be visiting. And as I say, do we care? Do you care? Are you listening to this going, no, I don't care if the high street dies. You know, I don't use it. I do just do my own shopping online. I do just go to these retail parks. I couldn't care less. You know, if that's the case, it's kind of fine, isn't it? Because they won't be around in their current shape or form for much longer because they'll just be gone. And this is not negative, Georgie. This is just the kind of the shape and flow of how the country's going. It's going very kind of American, I would say, in this regard. You know, it's kind of feels like it's a bit of a US.
I think it's negative, though. I rarely go to these mall things, but I go to my local high street and I know Greg, who owns the coffee shop, and I like to have a croissant in the morning. You know, I know the people in town, and it would be an absolute shame if I had to go to some sort of soulless retail park, which, you know, serves me up not what I want and sort of delectable delights that I'm not, you know, sure is going to be there. Like the little gift shops you get and you think, I'll just take a little look round and whatnot. You're never going to get that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I want the high streets to survive. That's why I want the high streets to survive and thrive for that very reason. You know, you could, I could be anywhere in the world when I go into those retail parks. Mm. You know, another Costa.
I think there's a good point there. I think that actually the high street, be that a small high street or a bigger high street, I think arguably you could make an argument that it's good for people's mental health. And it's better for their mental health than going to an out-of-town retail park. And it's better for the mental health of the people working there. What's not good for their mental health is the hassle of actually trying to be able to go there. And that's what makes people go to out-of-town retail parks. And I think that the councils need to be held responsible for this in many cases, because if you wander around and you ask shopkeepers, you know, what is your main issue? They always say parking. That's the one number one that always comes up number one. And if you ask people, you know, why don't they visit the shops, you know, their high street, they often say parking. But there is an attitude from councils, comes down, you know, from civil servants and government sometime, that, well, you're just wrong, you shouldn't be driving to the shops. It's just you're morally wrong to be driving to the shops. You know, well, you say parking, but like, we're going to ignore that bit where you're a shopkeeper and you've been a shopkeeper here for 40 years and you've said your biggest problem is parking. We're going to ignore that because you shouldn't think that. You're wrong thinking. And, you know, the reality is that they get ignored and then the parking charges come in and then you wonder why people don't go to the high street and they drive to the out-of-town retail park where they can park for free and it's easier to get to. The council, you know, you talk to the councillors when they come round to the doorsteps about this, and this is what's really galling about this for people, is we had local elections. When they came round to people's doorsteps, they were challenged. You're going to bring in paid for parking. And there was loads of stuff being put in, you know, the letters being written to the local newspaper, stuff going up on the local Facebook group. And the Lib Dem councillors who were standing for election were quite angry. They're like, no, this is mudslinging. This is the Tories mudslinging. We're not going to bring in paid for parking. We don't plan to do that. There's no plans to do that, but we're not intending to do that. We're not just going to get elected and do that. And the Tories are like, yes, you are, and so on. So they get elected. A few weeks later, out comes a consultation bringing in paid for parking. So people are quite rightly up in arms about this. There's an argument, oh, well, you know, you have to pay for parking in St. Albans, but St. Albans is a shopping destination in a way that, like, the smaller town isn't. But also, it's the thing where, basically, the argument is then, well, you should use public transport, or you should walk to the shops, you shouldn't drive to the shops. But it's like, for the people who live within walking distance of the shops, that is fine. The people who live within walking distance of the shops should walk to those shops, right? There is no public transport.
That's true.
Like, there aren't any buses. There are some buses, but they are really, really poor, really, really inferior. And most parts of the town don't have a bus. I would say people should cycle. there's no off, there's not like not the off-road cycle routes. There's no cycle routes, and people don't want to cycle because they don't feel safe. You should cycle, by the way. I cycle all the time. I cycle to work every day. It's much safer than you think. Get on your bike. It's really good for you, and it's also good for your mental health. But people won't cycle because they don't feel it's safe. They don't feel they have any choice but to drive to the town centre. And things like this, I'm baffled by. I look at it and I go, why, if you were lucky enough to have one of the few places in the country that still has a relatively thriving high street, would you make a decision that is ultimately going to kill it off? Mm. Baffles me.
Indeed. Right, Simon, you've thrown a few numbers in there, but I want your stat of the week. It's back. Do you have one for me?
My stat of the week. Out of a litre of petrol, which costs, on average at the moment, £1.42.17, so 142.17p, mm-hmm. How much of that do you think is fuel duty?
Of how much?
About £1.42. Let's call it £1.42. How much is fuel duty?
£19.
How much?
£1.19.
Oh, no, actually, it's much lower than that.
I was a bit overexcited there.
2.95p. So, but then you have to add on the VAT on top of that. That's another 24.7p. Right, yeah. So the total tax out of your litre of petrol is 76.65p. So more than half, 54%, in fact, of every litre of petrol that you buy is tax.
A lot.
And you will have paid tax on the income you used.
Thank God I don't rule the country, because it would be a lot more. Right, that is it. Thank you very much, Simon. Thank you very much, Lee. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast paths and join in the debate in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, sorry. It's yawning. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too. Boom. I've not been the same since I smacked my head. I've been all like...
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.